Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. I'm your host, Gary Gramling. This week we are going to talk trade deadline deals. We're also going to break down some of Week 8's headlining games. But first, as we always do, let's open up the phone lines. Our first caller is Andy from Idaho. Hello, Andy. do you have a song request?
You know, Gary, I'm excited to talk this stuff with you because it has been a few weeks since you and I talked football.
It has. I mean, we've talked. We've been in touch. We haven't spoken publicly. Andy is joining us as a special guest this week. We will have him on, I guess, as frequently as possible. I don't know how frequent that will be, but he's here now, and that's what's important, and that's why we will cherish this time together as we talk about Mohamed Sanu and other things. So let's get to the trade deadline stuff first. And yeah, let's start with Sanu. Sanu to the New England Patriots. And I'll kind of set it up this way for you, Andy. When he signed that free agent deal with the Falcons a couple years ago, it was kind of like, wow, Mohamed Sanu got a lot of money for a guy who's, you know, it doesn't put up big numbers. He's not a guy who draws a lot of attention. And now he draws a second-round pick from the Patriots. A second-rounder from Mohamed Sanu, who is, you know, he's not a big-play guy. He's not like the kind of outside guy I think you look at with this offense and say, well, this is what they need. However, it seems anyone you talk to in the NFL and Mohamed Sanu comes up, they just say, wow, he is a really good player.
Yeah, he is. He's a good stabilizing player. The Falcons felt that way about him. When I was at their rookie mini camp, he was an example they put up on the board for the rookies on their PowerPoint, their slideshow of what's possible in the NFL, what you can be. Because Mohamed Sanu does not have great measurables, but his impact and his productivity over the years has been irrefutably steady and impressive. I didn't think he was worth a second round pick either, though. That if Atlanta were 6-1 and fulfilling Gary Gramling's preseason prediction of a Super Bowl run here, I think they probably still would have made this trade. I was really surprised, and it's going to be a late second rounder most likely because it's New England. Mm-hmm. But Gary, I don't know exactly what role he'll fill because N'Keal Harry, and we don't know what his status is, but. You know, even if N'Keal Harry does not get healthy at some point, obviously Edelman's the guy the offense runs through. I think Jacoby Myers, the undrafted rookie, has looked very good so far, and Philip Dorsett has gotten very effective as a downfield player within the context of their scheme. So I'm not sure what Sanu feels other than maybe they're viewing him. They're not going to play him at tight end, of course, but maybe they view him as the guy they'll go with more four receiver sets and he can do some of the stuff that the tight end would normally do. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I thought of him as basically a tight end that they're bringing in almost. And like you said, he's not a guy you're going to line up in line and do it that way, but he can do a lot of different things. And you look at what a guy like, whether it's Lacoste or Izzo or those guys they have been playing at tight end have basically been out there. I made the comparison to, you remember Nazi Muhammad, the guy who played in the NBA for like 15 years, and all
yes,
he did was set screens, and everyone loved him because he just set really good screens. He was like a fairly mobile big guy, and he was just a great screener. And these tight ends that the Patriots have now, it's like that's all they do is just set screens now. And now I guess you have a guy who can do that, but he can also, you know, catch the ball if you throw it to him.
Well, what's interesting, New England wants to be a run-based offense, but they've had injuries at fullback. James Devlin went down. Johnson went down. Jacob Johnson, he was playing very well in place of Devlin. And it looks like they finally threw up their hands because it was Eric Tomlinson last week that kind of filled that role, and he's now since been released. He was a blocking specialist for the Jets for a while. So the Patriots really, Gary, they don't have the personnel to play the way that they set out to play this season. They've had a lot of little tiny changes. You wouldn't think a James Devlin injury would knock him out like that, but they're going to have to go in a different direction. The other guy who has not been in is Rex Burkhead, and that's important because one of the things they were doing to replace their tight end in the passing game was go with those two back sets, Burkhead and James White on the field together. So all the little wrinkles that they were doing to offset the absence of Gronkowski, they've fallen by the wayside because of freak injuries to guys that you wouldn't think are difference makers. And now all of a sudden, here's the latest effort, most likely. It's Sanu as the next guy to fill the Gronkowski-type-ish role.
I know, and look, we all know the Patriots treat the season as a process, And it's like now you have this situation where it's like they're already sitting at 7-0. This wasn't one of the slow start 2-2 September type of years. So they have 7 wins in their pocket already. And now they have, you know, basically a wide margin for error going from here on out in the regular season to kind of figure out their identity and maybe try a couple things over the next 2 months.
Well, for the most part, your Buffalo Bills, though, have only one loss. They're in second place of the whole AFC. So it's not the same cushion right now that it normally is in that division.
Game and a half, though, and they got the win in Buffalo.
I hear you.
It's over.
We're about to fall into this Patriot argument we've had before. And then here comes the rookie wage scale. So we better just let you move on to the next topic.
We got to get all the classics in here, Andy. Let's go Emmanuel Sanders to the 49ers. Another receiver deal. A couple of mid-round picks going for Sanders. So a nice little return for the Broncos there. But this one's pretty easy to figure out because it's the same offense and it's Emmanuel Sanders in a Kyle Shanahan offense here.
And Sanders can still play. He has some juice left, which is impressive because he's coming off some notable injuries in the recent past. And I like the style of fit here, Gary. I don't think he changes the makeup of the receiving core, but they didn't need a change of makeup. That's a very good receiving core. In fact, I think it's one of the best coached wide receiving units in the NFL when you put on their film. What I was taught is the way to analyze a coach from afar, because you really, it's hard to analyze coaches, of course. But the way a Bill Belichick does it, for example, they look at the technique of the players at that position. We're talking analyzing a position coach here. You look at the technique of each player and you gauge how similar is it from guy to guy. How are their mechanics? How's the output? Guys are going to have different skill sets, but are they playing within their techniques the same way or relatively the same way? San Francisco's receivers look like the same guy on every snap. I have to constantly check the numbers on the film because you can't tell by the body types and the movement who is who. These guys are so precise in what they're doing. The coaches at wide receiver for the Niners, it's Wes Welker, former Patriot, and it's Mike LaFleur, Matt's little brother, 32-year-old coach. Those two guys are doing a great job. And Sanders, stylistically, he fits very similar to what they do. He's a lot like Marquise Goodwin or Dante Pettis, these good, quick, darting movers that the Niners have.
Yeah, it's a nice group there. And look, the 49ers are still finding their way offensively here. It's been the defense carrying them early on.
Yes, they are. And Kyle Juszczyk out of the lineup, that's a big deal. They've survived it so far. They haven't been super tested with it. They ran into a Rams team on their worst day, the Rams' worst day. And then they played the Redskins in a slop fest. So we haven't seen them get totally tested yet. They had the Panthers this week, so that's a little bit more of a formidable defense.
Let's go to this one that I think both of us probably shed some tears over this. I know I did.
Yes.
Quandre Diggs from the Lions to the Seahawks. I mean, look, Diggs has been banged up this year. He was back in the lineup last week, and things didn't work out very well for the Lions defense against the Vikings. So I guess I understand the Lions sort of looking at this and saying, we have three guys we like in Tracy Walker and Tavon Wilson and Will Harris there.
Mm-hmm.
We have three safeties we like. Diggs has a bit of a backloaded deal relative to, it's not a huge deal either way. But, you know, if they're kind of saying, you know, we're probably going to move on from Diggs anyway in the offseason, let's just get something for him now. This return was nothing. They're getting a fifth rounder and they're giving up a 2021 seventh rounder. So this was this was as close to a giveaway as you can get for a, I would say, at worst, starting caliber player.
Which then makes you wonder if the Seahawks are viewing him as a rental for this season because of that backloaded contract. I'm looking up right now. It's one thing to be backloaded. You have to see how much dead money results from that as well, though. That's a big deal. Quandre Diggs, he has not had the season this year that he had last year. He has not been I don't want to say he's not the same player, because I do think he is the same player. He just hasn't been quite as dynamic. But that's not a guy you just trade away. And the reaction of the Lions players, a lot of them publicly on Twitter, verifies what we have long suspected about Quandre Diggs from afar. He is beloved on that team because he is just a football player pure through and through.
It's I'll just say, when I saw it come through on what was that, Tuesday afternoon?
Yeah,
I stood up in the office and said, did the Lions really just trade Quandre Diggs? And the reaction I got from the people in our open newsroom setup there were, who is Quandre Diggs? So I guess that's part of the issue there. And
I reacted the same way. And last week when the Rams announced the Peters trade, Ryan Taylor, our researcher, he texts me this stuff a lot because he knows I'm not sitting on Twitter all day. So if there's something that he thinks I'd want to know urgently, he'll send me a text. So he texts me Peters to the Ravens. I looked at the phone. Okay, all right. That surprises me. Back to the film. Then I got Ramsey to the Rams. Looked at the phone. All right, well, that's a big one. Back to the film. Quandre Diggs got traded. I stood up out of my chair as well, and I said, what?
It was like a scene out of The Shining. Andy and I just with the mind meld going there.
And he can be cut. I'm looking up now. He has a 5.2 cap hit next year, but he can be cut with no dead cap. So most likely, Gary, the Seahawks are viewing him as a one-year rental, and then Quandre Diggs will probably be a free agent. And he's probably going to be one of those guys who's forever underpaid.
Yeah. Nah, that's a shame. And look, it's not... The Lions last year when they traded Golden Tate and really didn't have any answers at receiver after that, that felt like a white flag. I'm disappointed they moved Diggs. I don't know if this is necessarily an admission that you know, they're sitting there at 2-3-1 and it's time to look forward to 2020. Obviously, the NFC is stacked. They have quite a climb coming up here, but
They wouldn't view it like that though. They still have a lot of these division opponents on their schedule, 2-3-1, and they very well could be 5-1, or I guess 2-3-1. Yeah, 5-1. I hate these tie records. Tie records are a pain. But I understand why we have ties. Now, that's another one we get into sometimes.
Sometimes, but we're both right on it.
Okay, they're not waving the white flag though. If they are, they're not. I'm not even going to go hypothetical. They're not waving a white flag here.
Yeah. No, they're not. But it's still a little bit disappointing. They break my heart at the trade deadline for a second straight year. The other one, former first-round pick Garyon Conley of the Raiders. They ship him to the Texans just in time for Raiders-Texans game, by the way.
Oh, yeah, you're right about that. Wow. The last time the Texans made a trade, it was Demaryius Thomas last year. I'm sure it wasn't their last trade, but that happened last year. Thomas played played his former team his very first game.
Oh, that's right. You save on travel that way.
Seems
like more of a Bengals move to do that, but Texans found some efficiency here. But Garyon Conley, I mean, look, he's been down this year. I don't know if obviously the Raiders have seen enough, and Houston is very thin at cornerback right now with all their injuries, so they're looking for anyone they can plug in there. But I don't know. What's your assessment of Conley at this point, and what's your assessment of Conley dropping into that sort of cover four Texans defense?
Well, I think he's looked okay for the most part in Oakland. Just okay, though, and he's a little bit high and low. And I know last night I put on that Packers-Raiders film late last night, and the first thought I had after seeing about 20 of Gary Conley's snaps was, I wonder if the Raiders made the decision to trade him after this game, because that was probably his worst outing as a Raider. He really struggled in that contest. And yeah, I wonder that. I really do wonder if they made that decision then, because that's a lot to give up. Now, the previous regime's the one who brought Conley in. It wasn't the Gruden regime. And we've obviously seen with Gruden, that means something. He's going to go with his guys over the previous groups of guys, which is fine. That's what he's there for. I think the Texans have a chance to get a pretty good value here, though. Conley's not a world beater, but I think he can be a solid corner within the context of a scheme. So if he understands how to play to safety help, and he's tackling well, he's being the best of Conley is a very solid corner. Let's put it that way.
All right. Well, that's, I mean, look, Lord knows the Texans addressed the offensive line. The secondary continues to be a problem. Now they've addressed that to an extent, and not nearly as impressive as bringing in Laremy Tunsil, but putting more bodies back there, I guess. Moving on from the Aaron Colvin dark days there. So, I don't know. Houston's still interesting going forward. All right, let's get to the games here, Andy. We're going to break down three of them. We're going to get to Browns-Patriots. We are going to also talk Bengals-Rams in London, but we're going to start with the Sunday nighter, and that is Packers-Chiefs. And I mean, look, we've been kind of waiting for the Packers to sort of have that offensive breakout, and I don't know. I just figured it would come after the return of Davante Adams, but you got a huge outburst against the Raiders last week at Lambeau Field, and I don't know. Was that a matter of the offenses getting right? Was it a matter of the Raiders being bad defensively, or was it some sort of mix of the two?
Well, it's a mix of the two. But and by the way, I have little helmets that I hang on the wall here. It's great for the games each week. That's where I look to see the schedule when I'm in my football room. And I was putting up Packers Chiefs. I thought, why isn't everyone talking? This is the big game of the year, Rodgers versus Mahomes. Oh yeah, I forgot. Now I'm disappointed. Then I think, oh, now we got Dolphins, Steelers, Redskins, Vikings. Boy, it's a tough week for primetime football with that Patrick Mahomes injury, especially. As far as what it means for the Packers, or what are they back on track, or are they on track? They certainly look better than they have at any point this season. And they did bump into a Raiders defense that had some issues in coverage. They blew a couple of coverages, man and zone. Some guys not on the same page. But I thought the Green Bay offense, for one, there were more defined route combinations throughout the duration of the play. It was a lot more of a structured offense all the way through, snap to snap in this game against Oakland. What I really liked is they threw the ball out of 21 personnel. Dan Vitale at fullback, that guy has some movement ability, Gary. I don't know, he's not Kyle Juszczyk. But he had a 22-yarder on a vertical route out of the fullback spot, which is really tough to defend. Zone defenders are not taught to defend vertical routes there. And then he had a catch in the flat where he quickly turned upfield. He just showed some quickness and shiftiness. They were moving him all around and then running their pass concepts accordingly. So they did a great job with shifting and motioning out of 21 personnel. And that's a very Kyle Shanahan-ish tactic. And Matt LaFleur, of course, that's the influence. And really, Gary, I think the first time I felt like I'm seeing a LaFleur offense on film, he's really doing more Shanahan stuff than McVay stuff so far, it looks like.
Yeah, and by the way, Vitale, I can't remember, they either call him Ultraback or Superback at Northwestern, but he does, he has that sort of, we'll call it a poor man's Juszczyk kind of skill set there. But yeah, I mean, he's a usable player, and you wonder when we're going to start to see more guys like that sort of finding their place in the NFL at this point. Other side of the ball, it's not Patrick Mahomes. It's going to be Matt Moore on Sunday night. I will point out a little preview of the Friday MMQB gambling podcast. Matt Moore has covered the spread in 2/3 of his starts, which kind of tells you he's been sort of underrated, underappreciated when he gets under center there. Now, I mean, we've talked on this show quite a bit. Yes, all the second reaction stuff with Mahomes is incredible, but even if you take away the second reaction stuff, you still have an absolute stud quarterback. You will not have the second reaction stuff with Moore. Just running this offense on schedule, especially against a very good and very much improved Mike Pettine defense in Green Bay, can the Packers find find some points here?
Well, I think what the Chiefs will have to do to find points is, for one, have a running game out of 11 personnel. Because if they go to 11 personnel, my guess is Green Bay will go to dime and put Redmond down in the box, and they bring in Chandon Sullivan back at safety. He's playing ahead of Josh Jackson. Josh Jackson's looking like a bust, Gary. Second-round pick a year ago, and he can't get on the field ahead of Chandon Sullivan when they're already thin at safety because Savage is out. But anyway, that's what Green Bay does. They put 60 DBs on the field. They might go nickel and play Oren Burks with Blake Martinez at linebacker, but most likely they'll go dime. And I think they've been a little bit vulnerable in run defense at times out of that lighter sub package. So can Kansas City run the ball and keep themselves on schedule that way? Now, we don't typically think of Andy Reid as a guy that runs the ball. So let's discuss the passing game, because they will call up on that. And they're going to call up on that probably more than we would expect, because that's the nature of their offense. Man coverage is clearly the blueprint for defending this offense, Gary. And that was true when Alex Smith was quarterbacking it, by the way. And it's been true this year with Mahomes. You've even had man coverage teams zone coverage teams like the Colts played man-to-man. The Texans went almost all man-to-man. The Lions are already a man coverage team, but they outplayed the Chiefs when they saw them in Week 3. So that's the blueprint. The Packers, as I'm sure our listeners probably know, they play a lot of man coverage in Green Bay. The question is, how will they get to the man man coverage. If it's on first and second down, a lot of their man coverages are likely to start out as zone and just play out like man. Cover three, but with match principles. So cover three match. Basically, I'm in zone, and if anyone runs downfield towards me, I become a man defender on that guy. That's a little different than straight man-to-man from the standpoint of the Chiefs, because what the Chiefs build in their offense, there's a lot of answers for attacking initial cover three looks. So if you start out in some kind of zone look and play match zone rules, the Chiefs have a lot of answers for that in their offense. Where they struggle a little bit is when you play straight man with help defenders. So those are similar coverages, but to Kansas City, they're very different, which means throwing the ball on early downs when you're likely to get those cover three matches, that's a big deal for the Chiefs. So in summary, Gary, my answer is run the ball on early downs while also throwing the ball on early downs.
They got to run some halfback options.
Yes.
LeSean McCoy, 35 pass attempts, and then we're all set here. It's going to be interesting. I will just throw out my gut feel on this game, and you can react positively, negatively, or not at all. Balls in your court, Andy, but I think the Chiefs are. I think this is a toss-up game. I think the Chiefs can very easily steal this game. I know they're, again, not to make this into the gambling podcast pre-show, but they're getting like 4.5 points at home. They're significant underdogs at home. I think this is an even matchup here.
So are you saying they'll steal a game from the podcast or from the gambling podcast standpoint, or from the show, the standpoint of the show we're doing right now?
Both. I guess I put a lot of gambling information in that preview.
You think the Chiefs will win the game? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think it's a flat out 50-50 toss a coin game.
I wouldn't quite go that far, but I hear what you're saying, and if asked to agree or disagree and have to pick one of the two, I guess I'd say agree.
Okay.
Somewhere between agree and the no react at all option. I like that option.
I think no react is probably the way to go on that.
Well, the way to get Kansas City's defense is by running the ball, and that's one thing we have not seen from the Packers yet. They really don't have a run game identity. They have not gotten that outside zone run game going. That will have to change at some point. It's not going to have to change in this game necessarily, but for them to get to where they want to be, I assume that's top of the mountain at the NFC at least, they're going to have to get their run game on track. Kansas City might be a good place to at least try to do that. Chiefs are very inconsistent in run defense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they did do it in that Dallas game. They got it going a little bit, and we just haven't really seen it since.
Yep.
Let's go Browns Patriots here. What was supposed to be sort of the old guard versus the new guard. I think the new guard is probably not quite ready to compete, but. Let's just talk about what New England is doing defensively. As everyone knows, they use the cover zero blitz heavily on Monday night. They are the first team ever to run even a single cover zero blitz in a game. So that made it big news. But it seems like they are, if you're just stepping back and saying, what's the identity here? It seems like this is getting to be a lot more like the old school, the Teddy Bruschi defenses, Ted Johnson defenses of the early and mid aughts, as opposed to the sort of contain and win in the red zone type of defenses that they had maybe more recently in New England.
I tell you, when I went to Texans training camp a few years ago, the Texans took the media out to a nice steak dinner at Jerry West's steakhouse. Jerry West had a steakhouse in this at the Greenbrier, and it had all the greatest Jerry West memorabilia you could find. I went up and used the restroom. When I came back to my table, Ted Johnson was sitting in my seat, and I was startled at the complete lack of courage I had to even consider the notion of trying to return to my seat with Ted Johnson in it. That guy has the thickest neck and the broadest shoulders of anyone I've ever seen.
Yeah, he's got some injury issues though, so you might have been able to get an early shot in, and then you're the victor.
I don't know. Possibly. He's got a big personality too, so I knew if it didn't go well, the whole restaurant would know about it. Now, fortunately for me, Ted Johnson's a great guy, and we had a wonderful night. And I think he noticed me meekly taking his seat and then hoping no one would notice, and he was cool about it. You know, it all worked out. But Ted Johnson, you said that, and I got chills down my spine a little bit. This defense does look closer to those old Patriot defenses than the ones that we've seen in most recent years. Now, and I was a kid at the time that Bruschi was doing his stuff. So I wasn't breaking down their coverages. I want to say though, I'm willing to bet they didn't play as much straight man to man as they do now. back then. But as far as the diverse fronts and the false blitz looks, that's a big Belichick staple, and they're doing a great job with it this season. A lot of teams have had success figuring out the Jets' protection rules so far. So that was part of it. They saw some things on film. Gase knows that Belichick, he and Belichick have a really deep understanding of each other. They've played for a lot of years. They had the rivalry when Gase was in Denver, always playing New England, then Miami, New England. Those two know each other very intimately. So I'm sure what Gase was thinking that night was, all right, he knows our protections. We're not going to keep guys in to help pass protect because we're just wasting bodies in the passing game if we do that. Let's trust our quarterback to get the ball out quickly then. And Gase got a lot of criticism for it because the quarterback did not respond well to that. But that was the thinking and that was the logic. And that's what New England does to you. They make you have to do these reactionary ideas, a little bit uncomfortable. You don't feel like you have a lot of options because you want to try to be a little bit simpler against them. And it can all snowball from there. And this is relevant because Baker Mayfield, he's not going to struggle the way Darnold did the other night, but Mayfield's having the kind of trouble reading coverages and defensive looks this year. Belichick's going to come back to what he did against Darnold tactically.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was going to say, what's the deal with Baker Mayfield right now? What are his issues at this point?
Well, the issue is he's not seeing the field with the same clarity at all, and especially against two deep zone looks. It started out in week one, and it really hasn't fully improved. Every once in a while, you see a bullet throw or a Baker Mayfield tight precision passing. You go, okay, here we go, and it just doesn't build on itself at this point. So that's the issue. Now, what's interesting is what we just described is the guy struggling to read coverages. New England doesn't challenge you quite as much in that sense because they're so man-to-man oriented. But one thing they do out of man coverage is they bring help defenders from different spots. So you don't know where the help is coming from sometimes. And that can give some zone elements to the man-to-man. So it'll be interesting to see how comfortable Mayfield is reading that because he struggled reading zone coverage more than man coverage. Any QB would. But New England has zone elements sometimes in their man coverages.
I mean, this just seems like a nightmare matchup for Baker. Fortunately for them, I guess they had the bye week, so you have a little bit of extra time to prepare. But this seems like the wrong matchup for him at this time.
Well, you know, to be honest, it better not be because you went out and got all these weapons. We made all this big deal about Beckham, and now it's Landry, who I think got a little bit overrated in the hype of the Browns, but he's a good player. Callaway is a speedster. They have all these answers at wide receiver. You should feel comfortable going against a team that plays man-to-man coverage. That's the point of having these great receivers.
All right. I just want to say before we move on, I really like the visual of you at the Greenbrier in a custodian's closet waiting for your food to be served.
Yeah, that was a fun night. It was tremendous. I mean, do you ever go out and you decide, all right, tonight I'm just going to get sick. It'll be worth it. I don't care how I feel for 3 days after this. I'm just eating anything I see. I've had two nights like that in my professional career. That one night at the Greenbrier, and then a few years earlier on the MMQB tour with Peter King, we went into the St. Louis Cardinals
St. Louis baseball team.
This is the summer MNQB training camp tour. I guess I should have said training camp tour. St. Louis Cardinals suite. The Rams hosted us. This is when the Rams were in St. Louis, and they brought in food carts, and one of them was the most delectable chocolate food cart I've ever seen. And I thought, here goes all my self-respect, and I don't. That's what tonight is. But I didn't have to hide to eat that food. The Ted Johnson night, I did. I took my steak in the janitor's closet.
Is there any room in the bathroom stalls? Bengals Rams in London. Jalen Ramsey. Jalen Ramsey is a Ram. He made his debut last week as they trounced the Falcons. I just remember, Andy, last year the Rams, especially when Talib was out, they had Peters traveling, covering number one corners. It didn't work, but it seems like Ramsey, and you know, I'm sure you remember from our conversation with AJ Bouye, this is what Jalen Ramsey wants to do. Travel around with number ones, be a true flat-out man corner, and it seems like he might have the opportunity here.
Oh, absolutely. That's what he's here for. Jalen Ramsey was traded on Tuesday last week, so he probably got to Los Angeles late Wednesday, I'm guessing. We could know this for sure, but let's say he got there midweek. A few days later, he's on the road with them at Atlanta. And hey, Jalen, here's your assignment today. You're going to play in the nickel packages. You don't have to worry about base, but you'll be in nickel. And you got Julio Jones. And let us know if you need anything. But it's you over there with him and just go at it. And Ramsey played on an island most of the time. Not all of the time, but most of the snaps. It was one-on-one, Ramsey versus Julio. Julio got him a couple times, and Ramsey got Julio a couple times. And that's as hard a challenge as you could step into from an individual standpoint. There are more difficult offenses to face this year than the Falcons. The Bengals are not one of them, but moving forward, he'll see different stuff at some point. But to line up against Julio Jones one-on-one and at least fist fight him to a stalemate, that's what he's here to do.
And what does that do for the rest of this defense? I mean, what can Wade Phillips do that maybe he couldn't do when it was Peters and Tlaib and not really that true number one?
I think you'll see more man coverage from them. Really what they do, they're primarily a one deep safety defense. So they play cover three zone with one deep safety, or they play man to man. It's usually man robber. So one deep safety, and then the other safety comes swooping down the middle of the field and helps out. And for the last few years, their outside defenders, especially their slot guys as well, they play to the help of the robber. So they kind of cheat their man coverage knowing that they've got that guy in the middle of the field helping them. Well, I bet you what we'll see is the robber being more aggressive, helping everyone else, and Ramsey not cheating to the robber. So you have Ramsey one-on-one, and then everybody else can cheat to the robber. And because Ramsey's doing it on an island, there's now less field to defend, which means your robber can be more aggressive and play more routes at once. And Eric Weddle's probably the guy they do that with. Marquise Christian's the other safety who's in, but Weddle's very good at all this stuff. So you have Weddle, and you have a number one corner. You can move around and match up now in your secondary. They can go to cover three if they want to just stabilize things. Ramsey played a lot of that in Jacksonville, but I think in their money situations, Gary, it's going to be those man coverages. And the other thing we might see is a little bit more blitzing if they can go man free and then send a fifth rusher after guys. They don't necessarily have to do that because they have Aaron Donald. They can dictate matchups up front. But when they did bring pressure against Atlanta the other day, they had a lot of success with that tactically.
This is Oh my goodness, like Aaron Donald against this offensive line is going to be, I don't know how you can really function as an offense in this game.
This will be one of those games that the Bengals will demand to see Aaron Donald's birth certificate before they play when he shows up. It's going to look like he's not allowed to be on the field with them.
All I know is old podcast favorite John Jerry has been lining up at left tackle for the Bengals now.
And it's been a massive upgrade at times, too. That's the state of that offensive line. It's too bad. I feel for Zach Taylor, and I have a good relationship with him, so that might be part of it. But any coach that is just hamstrung, and he would never put it this way, nor should he, but they can't run their offense with that front five right now. They can't compete. They're not good enough up front to block for the plays to work. And some of their stuff they're doing downfield, they've got some great designs. In fact, there's been a lot of teams around the league have copied some of the things the Bengals showed in week one because they were so successful strategically against Seattle, but the execution has no chance to be there. You can only watch the routes unfold. You don't actually get to see the ball thrown because the offensive line is so inept and the quarterback is not equipped to play behind any kind of line close to that.
And what do you think of this Rams offense? Did they get right last week, or was it just a matter of, it was the Falcons? The Falcons kind of haven't stopped anyone this year.
Well, I still need to see that film, to be honest with you, and I'm eager to answer that question. I wish I had an answer for you right now. Jared Goff is usually the indicator, as most quarterbacks would be in their system. But when Goff is functioning at the intermediate levels and getting the ball out on schedule and on time and seeing things clearly, that offense is clicking. When he's not, the offense doesn't click. Now, what makes Goff not see things? Probably when his offensive line, his O-line, just like the Bengals, his O-line, when it struggles, he's going to struggle a little bit. I don't think he's utterly dependent on an O-line, but he is the type of QB that does need at least a solid line in front of him in order to be consistent, and that's probably how most QBs are. So can they get that offensive line stabilized? And they've had a lot of young guys and change of personnel inside. They traded for Austin Corbett, so they're looking for answers. that's the big key is what will that offensive line look like? And you know, let's say it takes some time still. Can they find ways to win in the meantime? They have a great opportunity here to get to 5-3 going into the bye week. So there's theoretically 2 or 3 weeks to groom that offensive line even more before you have another game.
All right, Andy, it is time. Not lightning-ish. This one's the straight up lightning round. We're going to run through the rest of the action from week 8. We're going to keep that mini mailbag on hiatus for a little bit longer. Hopefully it'll come back in December or so. So stay tuned for that. But it's time for the lightning round. I'll give the game. I'll pose the question and you tell me what's going on.
And I go quickly, right? That's the point of this.
It's quickly. Yes. So start your stopwatch. Or turn your hourglass over, or just keep an eye on the sundial as we do this. Jets Jaguars. Okay, what went wrong Monday night for the Jets? And I guess the question going forward, does Darnold bounce back sooner rather than later from that?
I'm going to be optimistic and say, yes, Darnold bounces back sooner than later. It's not going to get worse than it was Monday night. We touched on it a little bit. The Jets have issues right now with teams exploiting their protection concepts. So what do you do? And Gase's answer is often to put it on the quarterback. Can Darnold get better there? This stuff will not be a big deal this week because Jacksonville does not blitz you a lot, and they don't change their defensive fronts a whole lot either. Not the way the Patriots do. So it's a good chance to see a defense. It's a good defense in Jacksonville, but you know what you're getting from them picture-wise. You didn't the other night. So Darnold, I think, has a much better chance to get on track here. I'm optimistic for him.
Panthers 49ers. So if Kyle Allen was like 3-1 or 2-2 at this point, do you think they'd still be rolling with him instead of a healthy-ish Cam Newton?
That's a good question, and I don't know if they would even privately have an answer for that. I do believe him. Ron Rivera's answer is, what do you do when Newton comes back completely? Is it him or Allen? And Rivera's answer has been, oh, I don't know, cross that bridge when we get there. I kind of believe Ron Rivera, that he doesn't completely know. I believe him, and I think they want to stick with Allen, and that feels like such a big jump that if you said your question 2-2 or 3-1, that's a really complicated question. Here's a bottom line, though, Gary. Take all the politics out of it, because the politics are what makes it complicated. The offense has looked worlds better with Kyle Allen than it has with Cam Newton as of late.
Yeah, yeah. Do you... Sorry to unlightning this, but
well, I kind of got it. I rambled and kind of we're done. This lightning round is screwed already. 2 games in.
My second part, it definitely looks better than Cam looked the first 2 weeks of the season. Can you go back to early last season when we were optimistic about what the Panthers were doing before Cam had the shoulder problems and kind of say, well, what if we could recapture that?
So it's Kyle Allen versus healthy Cam Newton of a year ago, like a year to date.
Like September, October 2019.
Yeah. I guess you would go with Cam Newton in that case, but that's if we were allowed to play those games, why don't we just say Cam Newton of 2015 when he was the MVP? It's right now, Cam Newton is not a quality quarterback compared to what Kyle Allen's doing for him. Newton has had some nice things in his career, but where he is right now, for whatever reason, it's not even close. He does not look like the same quarterback.
All right, Raiders, Texans, Will Fuller, more hamstring problems, going to miss some time. How does that change the complexion of this Texans offense, taking away that vertical threat?
It does change it. It condenses it, and they're not as effective when they get condensed like that, especially with Watson being an aggressive downfield thrower. Kenny Stills gives them a little bit of dimension, though. They did not have Stills last year when Fuller was out. So having Stills, I think, alleviates some of that, especially if you can put Stills in the slot where he's at his best as a vertical weapon. But there's no doubt they'll miss Will Fuller.
Eagles, Bills, another vertical threat. We have a theme episode here. The Eagles struggles offensively. Is it just a matter of getting DeSean Jackson back at some point and bringing back that vertical threat? Or is there something else going on here with his offense right now?
I think Jackson would help a lot. They would look like a different offense. It opens the field in new ways. One other thing to just consider, and it's more of just immediate recency, Andre Dillard's played at left tackle lately, and he's going to be a nice player. You can see he's got a lot of natural talent, but he's not quite ready yet, and he's really struggled against bull rushes particularly, but he's struggled overall in pass protection. Carson Wentz might be aware of that, and it might impact the way he plays ever so slightly. I remember back when Wentz, I think it was his rookie season, where Lane Johnson was out for an extended period, and Wentz's mechanics just kind of went to the gutter for a little while, at least by the high standards we hold Wentz to. You wonder if Wentz is one of those QBs. He's not dependent on his O-line because he is such a talent and he's tough as hell. So, you know, we don't worry about him that way. But you still want to know what your blocking is like. And if you know the blocking is not going to be as good, it's still going to impact the way you play. You might still be tough, but you're going to play a little bit differently. And I wonder if that factors in with Wentz a little.
You might be seeing ghosts, as some might say.
Yeah.
One person ever, though.
Yeah, thank you for that. The Jets had every right to be furious that that got out. That should not have ever gotten out. It makes Sam Darnold look bad, and it's unfair because all he meant is, I'm not reading the pass rush very well tonight.
Broncos-Colts. This Colts offense, are we seeing it evolve and expand, or is this just sort of a take your chances when you get it with Jacoby Brissett?
Well, you know how I feel about Brissett, so I'm going to take the evolve and expand argument because he has not thrown the ball downfield a lot this season. He's starting to a little bit more, and I think that's the evolution and the expansion you're talking about. They can do everything they want in the running game. They have speed, enough speed at wide receiver. Their O-line can pass block just with five guys for a long duration, and the quarterback has an arm. Not only should they expand, but there's really no limit on what they can do expansion-wise as long as Brissett plays well.
Chargers-Bears, and I'm not even going to mention Mitchell Trubisky here, Andy. Is there any chance this Chargers offensive line can handle the Bears front? It's a Bears front without Akeem Hicks now, and Russell Okung might be back.
If Okung gets back, that helps, but the Chargers have had some trouble at the guard spots and at right tackle. The Chargers just don't have a good enough offensive line. They're not in Bengals territory there, but they're much closer to that than they are to being average. So yeah. I'm going to answer no on that, unfortunately. And I don't think Chicago's D-line is playing as well as last year. Even, you know, Hicks being out's a big part of it, but just isolate the individual players. Khalil Mack runs a little bit hot and cold by his top shelf first ballot Hall of Fame standards. And the guys around him, Roberts and Harris, has had an excellent season, but we're just not seeing it the same way, especially not in run defense this year from Chicago.
Cardinals at Saints. Drew Brees' game time decision is what we're being told as we record this podcast.
Which, by the way, means absolutely nothing. It's everything in the Saints' benefit to say that. Why would you say anything else? Because now you got to prepare for all the possibilities of Brees or not Brees. They know if Brees can play or not. It's not like a tissue injury where you have to see how the muscle responds and how warm he is. It's a thumb injury. Can he pick up the ball and throw it or can't he? They know that, right? They'll know that Saturday night for sure.
Well, they could just have said game time decision every week from here, you know, going back to like week three.
That's what I remember the Patriots used to put Tom Brady on the injury report every week with a shoulder, just be Tom Brady's shoulder. Probable. I've always wondered what would happen if a team put like 40 guys as questionable on their injury report, because that's the first thing I would do if I got to be a head coach.
Well, do you remember probable gate between the Vikings and the Patriots?
Was that the one where there was a game? Does it involve Favre?
It was Mike Vick. The Falcons listed Mike Vick as probable with an injury, and he did not play. They ended up starting Matt Schaub the next day. Now, obviously, Mike Vick to Matt Schaub, that is a much different offense. So the Patriots took great exception to that. And if I remember correctly, the following week when they put out their initial injury report, they listed every player as probable.
Did they? I'm going to look that up. That's a great story. It's too bad I didn't know that. It's also too bad that for some reason when you said Falcons, I heard Vikings, and I guessed at Brett Favre. Remember when Brett Favre was listed as out for one of those Monday night games late in his career, and then all of a sudden he played?
I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, he was listed as it was at least out. I'm 99% sure they listed him as out. And then he played, and everybody said, wait a minute, you're allowed to do that?
This is, look at the things we're teaching each other. That may or may not be true.
Yeah, that's correct.
We should have researched it beforehand. But anyway, so let's get back to Cardinal Saints here, and I guess this is more of a broad question here, but if Teddy Bridgewater has made his last start of 2019, Do we rethink him going forward? Is he a legitimate option as the quarterback of the future in New Orleans? Is he more than just sort of the, like, you know, the backup that we kind of viewed him as 3 months ago?
Well, I certainly owe it to Teddy Bridgewater to acknowledge that he has played a lot better than I thought he'd play. And it's not just in the way that the output has been, it's also the process. He's made some tough throws at times. Now, he's still not a gunslinger. He'll never be that. But there have been times where it's an obvious pass situation, two deep safeties, and Bridgewater's gotten the ball in there, and on some far hash throws too. So he's making some throws that I didn't think he had it in him to make. And that's a lot of credit to him, and the fact that he's doing it at this point in his career, given where he's been, all the more impressive. I still think that what we're looking at is possibly the best backup quarterback in the NFL. I don't know if it'd go this way if you put him in a different system under different circumstances and had him be the guy. And I don't think there's any shame in being the best backup QB in the NFL, because what we're seeing right now, let's say the Saints go on to the Super Bowl, which I predicted them to. I think they will. That's my prediction anyway. Teddy Bridgewater would have been a huge part of that Super Bowl run, even if he doesn't take another snap from here on out. What he's done to keep them afloat, he's played just well enough, and Sean Payton has been amazing, and the defense has gotten better. This is exactly what you want. This is what a backup quarterback's supposed to do. This is ideal backup quarterbacking at its finest.
Seahawks at Falcons. Matt Ryan is another up-in-the-air type of guy at this point. But let's talk about the Falcons' pass defense right now, which has just been lit up by everybody. Why has it been bad, and do the Seahawks, with sort of a more unique passing attack, are they going to be able to take full advantage of it like everyone else has?
Well, what's not being talked about this year, Russell Wilson's having an MVP-type season, but he's playing in a much better passing offense, too, schematically. He's doing a great job of capitalizing on a well-schemed passing attack, and they're doing a nice job. They're using DK Metcalf in a lot of these designs, exploiting teams with downfield route combinations or designs that make it just hard enough to play against them, and they're going to do that against Atlanta. I don't know what's going on with the Falcons. It's bizarre, Gary, because this is a team that's been well-coached and well-organized in a very straightforward scheme for several years. Same players, same coaches, for the most part, same players. And all of a sudden, they're having breakdowns week after week on routine execution plays.
Giants, Lions, the Quandre Diggs-less.
Diggs-less.
What do you make of Daniel Jones, though? He's been a little bit shaky. Obviously, you know, they went up to New England on a Thursday night. He had no players around him. But we haven't seen the guy we saw in the first start in the Bucs victory.
Yeah, it's almost like the teams have film on him now that the Bucs didn't have the advantage of viewing. And it's just rookie quarterback stuff. What do we want to say? This is how rookie quarterbacks perform. I don't think any different at Daniel Jones. I've been impressed with him so far in the bigger scheme, but yeah, he's having ups and downs.
Bucs, Titans, this Titans secondary, do they get to sort of feast against Jameis Winston here? Is six turnover Jameis going to be more likely than the sort of newish and improved-ish Jameis that we saw earlier in the year?
I'll give you one reason why it will and one reason why it will not. Well, let's do the will not first. When Winston gets turnover-y, turnover prone was a little more
we've got some
up.
Good adjectives
yeah
in this
we
show.
Do we're nailing this. When Winston turns the ball over, it tends to be when he tries to do too much. It's not so much when he gets fooled. He'll get fooled once in a while and make a bad decision. We've seen that. He'll be off target on a throw, but really when the turnovers come in buckets, it's when he's trying to do too much. The Titans are about fooling you. They're going to give you one look and rotate into something else. So I understand why we would think, all right, complicated defense, turnover prone quarterback, here they come. Here's the interceptions, but I don't know if it's going to quite go that way. Now that's one side of it. The other side is if Tennessee rushes three and drops eight into coverage, which they've been known to do, then Winston will start extending the play. And I think the longer Winston holds the ball, the more of a liability he becomes when it comes to decision making. So if I'm Mike Vrabel and Dean Pease, I'm running the Titans defense, I probably show them one thing. I show pressure. And I drop out and put eight, or I don't even show the pressure. I let them know, hey, Jameis, you've got all day to throw this, but there's eight of us back here, and you're not going to know where we're going to be at all times.
And Monday night, Dolphins at Steelers, the classic matchup we all expected here. Why have the Dolphins had relative success with Ryan Fitzpatrick as opposed to Josh Rosen the past couple of weeks?
I'm sick of Ryan Fitzpatrick questions because I don't know the answer to them. The guy uncorks it and it goes great sometimes, and other times it doesn't. And every time it's going the way it's going, you think it'll go that way forever. When he gets hot, you think, oh man, here he's got it, right? Look, Fitz magic. Then when he starts bumbling, you think, how is this guy on the field? That's all easy. An interception machine. We never enjoy the ride. Well, we enjoy the ride with Fitzpatrick, but we never assume it's going to change. We always think what we're seeing is what the end product is, and we know it's going to change. I don't know what Ryan Fitzpatrick will show up. I don't know why it works some weeks and not others. I don't know if anybody knows that.
That's a good ending. Your least favorite question to wrap this one up in your...
I took a knee on the end. I felt like I had a lead in this lightning round on this podcast, and yeah. I just gave you the I don't know, and I said everything and nothing at the same time there.
I should my live fact check here on our earlier injury report claims. I can tell you so that in that this was a 2005 game. Vic was probable on Friday, then downgraded to questionable on Saturday, and then out on Sunday. So Belichick the next week had 15 players on his injury report, and on the initial report listed all of them as probable, and then switched everyone to questionable the next day, except for Tom Brady stayed as probable.
That's interesting that he would take, because if he is questionable Saturday, well, I don't know. That's not as deceitful as I thought it'd be. I thought it'd be that he was probable and he stayed probable and no, just not out there.
But you've prepared all week for Mike Vick, and then on Saturday you find out you're getting Matt Schaub. Because probable, the way they used to define probable was, and I don't know if they still have this wording, it was something like, all but certain to play in his regular role.
Well, I would do exactly what the Falcons did every time if I could. Like, I thought about this Rams thing with Todd Gurley's knee, and I don't know what's up with Todd Gurley's knee, but let's say the rumors about the arthritic knee, let's say that's valid and those are true. Then the Rams not listing him on the injury report last year, I think that's okay, because if it's an arthritic knee, then that's just the state of his knee now. Like that's his knee. So he's not injured. That's just what he is.
Okay.
Is that fair? I don't know. Is that fair?
It's all relative. I mean, who's healthy? Who's ever healthy? We're all dying as soon as we're born.
Well, all right. Yeah, that's true. But like if a guy, let's say a guy, like, remember Ronnie Lott lost his finger. He cut the finger off to keep playing. It was a beer commercial about it. Would the Niners then have been obligated to list Ronnie Lott as questionable with a finger injury forever? Well, he's now a guy, he doesn't have that finger. So that's just what he is now.
He'd be probable with a finger, I would think, right?
Well, probable until Saturday, and then he'd be questionable, and then he'd be out with a finger injury. I don't know. But I don't know. The whole injury report thing, I don't know how you're held accountable for it. And it could also be one of those things that's so important that it's just worth taking the fines. I can't tell you how many times I've sat with a head coach and just said, well, why don't you just violate this rule? How much do they fine you for that? How much do they fine you for that? And when you add up the fines, I think, shoot, if I were a head coach, I get $5 million a year, I would just negotiate for, give me $550,000 a year, and I'll take, or, you know, $5.5 million a year, I mean, and I'll take $500,000 in fines and just do what I want with all these injury reports and criticizing the refs or whatever it is during the week.
You know what? The injury report, though, they would level you. They would start taking draft picks. They would do whatever they had to do to keep it away, because that's the gambling stuff. That's where you have to have the faith of the handicapping community. Otherwise, you just lose this gigantic chunk of people who are interested in your game for just that reason.
Fair enough, but how do you regulate it, though? Nothing's to stop my quarterback from stubbing his toe every Saturday night.
I guess so. All I know is I'm going to take away so many of your draft picks when I'm commissioner and you are head coach of the, I don't know, Boise
Braves.
Boise Wonder Boys.
All right.
All right. Andy, I have missed you dearly. I know our listeners have, because they heckle me about it every day and ask when you're coming back. So I'm glad you're back to answer the question that everyone has. I don't know how frequent this will be. I assume you will be back at some point soon. I don't know if it will be next week. I don't know if it will be the week after. We will figure this out as it goes. But I'm glad we did this dirty thing that we do on Wednesday evenings. The MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast is me, Gary Gramling. Thanks to our special guest this week, Andy Benoit. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB, and Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave us a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever you listen to podcasts.